This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, a profit windfall for an oil company while consumers face higher gas prices, and a girl sues for the right to wear the Confederate flag in school. Joining us today from our New York bureau, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, University Professor of Globalization and Education at New York University, and Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post. Also at member station WGBH in Boston, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. Thank you all for joining us. So I want to start out leading out of the conversation we just had about African and Caribbean immigrants. Robert, your family has West Indian roots. What about this idea that every immigrant we get here in the U.S. is part of a brain drain and people who could otherwise help their nations?
That's a good question. It was something I had not really considered until I listened to this conversation. My mother, my father, and myself, we were all born in Trinidad, and we came over here in the early 1970s. I think there may be a certain aspect. There may be some truth to that. However, for every situation is different. You have many, many families, of course, that when they do come over here, they often send remittances back. For example, and that certainly happens in the cases of Central America, South America, but that also happens in the context of African immigration and Afro-Caribbean immigration as well. So there's often a case where some of the investment, if you want to put it that way, that happens from the from the islands and the countries they're coming from, when they send immigrants over here, it certainly comes back to the other countries as well.
Marcelo, and just to follow up again on the same interview with the Haitian American, looking at the situation of immigration, he said that people who come from the Caribbean and Africa have to begin to join forces politically with African Americans to try to deal with questions domestically and in terms of international policy. Do you have any sense, doing the work that you do, that African Americans are able to join with Black immigrant groups, or is there a divide?
Well, I think that there are tremendous opportunities here. As Robert said, we are now facing a really unique phenomenon in the history of immigration to the United States. Sometime this decade, more Black origin people in the United States arrived as immigrants during the entire period of slavery. This is in the context of the largest wave of immigration in the history of our country, where we're really getting huge numbers of highly educated immigrants from Africa. The most highly educated immigrants in the United States today are Africans. They're more educated than Asians, they're more educated than Latin Americans. There are more doctors from Ghana in New York State than in Ghana. There are tremendous opportunity for really meaningful coalitions here that will have a profound implication for the transformation of our country moving forward. The other thing we need to keep in mind is we talk a lot about Latinos. Latinos is a cultural group, it's not a racial group. There are a lot of Black Latinos. In fact, the largest Latino population, the largest African American population in the African hemisphere is in Latin America. So we need to keep that in mind also when we talk about the tremendous complexity and diversity of the new wave of immigration. Highly educated people of color are coming in, and we're not really talking about the long-term consequences and the impact this has both nationally in terms of race relations in the United States, but also internationally in terms of global development.
And one quick point to keep in mind is also that many of those coming from Africa and from the Afro-Caribbean as well, many of them don't have, say, the same language barriers that many, say, Latino immigrants have, which in certain cases, not in all cases, but in certain cases, gives them something of a leg up in addition to the educational issues that the professor just mentioned.
And Callie, you are in Boston, and Boston, like many university cities, has a lot of immigrants who come to school, including a lot of Africans. Do you have any sense of, in Boston, whether there's a connection between the Afro-Caribbean community, the African community, and the Black community, or is it kind of oil and water?
It's both. Well, you know, I say that because if you go to some of the larger churches in the area, you will see a great mix of Afro-Caribbean in particular and African-Americans. A lot of that's where you'll see it. But, you know, on some of the college campuses particularly, I mean, Harvard just did a study about a year ago about there being more Afro-Caribbean and Africans on campus, or rather non-African-American blacks on campus. Fewer of those than the ones who come from someplace else. And that was an interesting study, and then they asked people how they thought about it, and some people expressed some tension around it. But I would say that this is an area, because it's one of the areas where there has been most a lot of immigrants come to, because they have family here and history here, where there is more of a long-term experience. And so I think that some of the tensions that might just be creeping to some of the elite schools, at least, have been worked out in other parts of the community. So I have to say both. You see both tension and you see both celebration and embracing. One thing I wanted to say was that watching these people in the street just reminded me so much of the marches in Washington and in Selma when African Americans were at the head of trying to secure rights for themselves here in this country as a part of the American Civil Rights Movement. And it's refreshing and exciting, I think, to see another wave of people out in the street asking for a different set of rights, but asking to be heard. And I think that there is a tremendous opportunity, as the professor noted, to build coalitions. And also I would ask people not to reinvent the wheel. Some of this has been done. And so build on what has happened from the American Civil Rights Movement, and let's go forward. And I think there could be some amazing and powerful coalition building going on in this country as a result of this.
One thing I would want to point out, though, is, I mean, there is, I know this question has come up a number of times in this, as we've had this discussion over the last several months. There's still this little talking point that comes out, and it's almost understood whether you're looking at it from liberals or conservatives. There's this assumption that they say that immigrants are taking the jobs that, quote, Americans don't want to do. And it was about a year or so ago where President Vicente Fox added on, well, it's the jobs that even black Americans don't want to do. And I think we have to keep in mind in the context of native-born Americans that, I mean, I think they are often competing for many of these lesser-skilled jobs. And I don't think we should just make this assumption that the black Americans, quote, don't want to do these jobs, and we have to recognize that there's going to be some tensions as people start vying for some of these same opportunities.
That's absolutely
definitely something that's got to be talked through if there's any coalition dialogue. But Robert, since you spoke up, I want to move you on to another topic, one with whom you are very familiar, Rudy Giuliani. He became a national figure after 9/11. He was a controversial mayor. Now it seems he's positioning himself to run for president. And yet he supports abortion rights, gay rights, gun control. That's going to make...
And immigration rights, too.
And immigration rights. So he's the kind of Republican who hasn't really been that popular even among Republicans. How is he going to win the nomination?
Carefully, it's going to be a very tough road for him to go through. A number of Republican strategists say, you know, you can be a Republican and be pro-choice or pro gun control or pro gay rights. You could be one of those. You can't be all three, which he has been so far. And I imagine you'll see him, you know, try and, you know, kind of shave off some of the edges on some of those individual issues. But I think the big problem for Giuliani is the fact that there's a particular image of Giuliani that both the Republican base saw and the broader public saw in the context of post 9/11. And what will end up inevitably happening if he decides to jump into the race, within the context of the primary process, the pre-9/11 Rudy Giuliani, which has many assets, but also has many liabilities as well, and that I think will, in a sense, kind of shave off some of the glow, and it may make it very difficult for him to get the nomination.
And we're talking about things like the fact that his marriage broke up very publicly, that during his term, there were several high-placed incidents of police abusing African Americans. And
yeah, and speaking of immigrants, you know, obviously the Amadou Diallo shooting. There was also Patrick Dorismond, who was a Haitian immigrant. They were both accidentally shot by police officers. And unlike, say, the current mayor and the current police commissioner, who tried to take a kind of a neutral viewpoint and criticize the police where appropriate, Giuliani was so reflexively supportive of everything that the police did in every aspect. I think it drained his credibility both with Africans and people of color in general in the city.
Callie, do you think he's got a shot?
Well, I was about to say that the
interesting choice of words there, Farai.
Right. That what Robert said, I mean, I'd just take it a step further and say Giuliani was almost a verb when you talked about some of the shootings and some of the incidents that happened under his administration. And that's how harshly folks in the African-American community were viewing
him. Actually, Callie, he was a four-letter noun, actually.
Okay, well, there you go. wherever we put the grammar, it was negative. So you got that going on. That's huge. And the second thing I got to say, okay, some have accused me of being a prude, but I'm sorry, it wasn't a failed marriage. This was a public affair, very, very public. And I just wonder, how does that play, particularly with the evangelical crowd, but certainly even with the family-friendly crowd? I mean, here's a guy who just flaunted this thing all out in the public. I got to feel as that that's going to come back and smack him somewhere.
And then there was the annulment that he had to his first wife, who turned out to be his cousin.
Well, there you go.
I've never heard of that, but you know. Yeah, that's right. I mean, Giuliani, and by the way, I will just say this. I mean, I think he did, there was a lot he definitely did for New York in the context of getting the city under control in terms of crime and so forth. But there are these kind of soap opera personal things surrounding him, too, that make it problematic.
Well, moving along to more problematic issues, a girl is suing her high school over trying to wear the Confederate flag as a fashion statement. She's in Florence, South Carolina. Her family has filed suit saying that she feels traumatized because she has to turn her clothes inside out or take off this, that, or the other garment. The school says it's a discipline issue because some of the other students don't appreciate her fashion sense. Marcelo, what should happen in a case like this?
Well, again, the key term here are fashion and her sense of trauma versus the disciplinary considerations of running a school. It seems to me that there's nothing traumatic about having to obey school regulations.
What about other designs? I mean, I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, you understand. I mean, is there, I know some schools have had similar controversies over the swastika. A student wanted to wear a swastika armband on a college campus. And in that case, I believe the college felt like, due to free speech concerns, they couldn't prevent the kid from wearing it. They wouldn't endorse it, of course, but they couldn't prevent it. Where do these lines get drawn in terms of issues that range from free speech to dress codes and discipline in schools?
Well, carefully, issue by issue, case by case, school by school, but certainly the school retains the right to require that students dress in certain ways or not dress in certain ways. And when we're dealing with offensive, assaultive symbols like the swastika or other such symbols, I think the school has the right to say we're not going to accept these kinds of dress codes.
Yeah, I mean, to talk about giving new meaning, I guess, to the word fashion Nazis. I think the key thing here is I personally feel that you go one way or the other. You either allow the kids to make whatever statement they want, whether it's about Malcolm X or about what or what have you. I mean, assuming that it's not lewd and lascivious, or you go as some public schools have just have. The kids wear uniforms, and so everybody is wearing the same kind of thing, and you don't have either people wearing offensive clothing, or you also don't have people don't have to keep up with the Joneses in terms of fashion. My own personal view is that the Confederate nation was a hostile power to the United States, and I don't think it really should be celebrated. But that's my personal viewpoint.
Kelly?
Yeah, I would have to underscore and say that if the school is making an exception in her case, then the school now is on kind of shaky ground. But I'm assuming that this is across the board, that they have set up rules about what students can wear in school, and then that should happen. And we should underscore that this is a high school, too. I think it gets a little murkier when you get to college and you're dealing with adults and you have the context of free speech, much as I would be just upset about seeing this walking around. But I think in a high school situation where the school has laid down some rules, then the student should follow those rules. And if they, however, have made exceptions for other people, then I think she's got a leg to stand on, unfortunately.
All right. This is a speed round. We have almost no time left. The radio station reporter and host, David Lenihan, who called Condoleezza Rice a slur and said it was a mistake, has now been embraced by the local NAACP, who called it a, quote, teachable moment. What is the lesson? Very quickly, Callie.
The lesson is you just can't make this stuff up. This is crazy. Go ahead. Anybody else?
Robert. I may be one of the few. I actually heard this guy, and I'm almost willing to accept him at face value when he said he meant to say the word coup, COUP, and he ends up saying coon, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if the NAACP says, you know, they feel that, you know, to use Jesse Jackson's favorite phrase, God isn't done with him yet, you know, fine. Let them do it and let them go forward.
You need prayer, Robert. Go ahead.
Marcelo.
Be careful what you say on the public radio.
It's a black thing. I can get away with it, I hope.
Uh-oh. All right. We're going to get a lot of letters about that. In our New York bureau, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, University Professor of Globalization and Education at New York University, and Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post, and from member station WGBH in Boston, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press. Thank you all.
Thanks, Farai.
Thank you.
Bye.